Hi, this is Tom Benedek. Okay, we're starting now officially. This is Tom Benedek, screenwriter, screenwriting teacher, first-time novelist, author of Peloponnesia, a novel about development hell, a very cushy corner of development hell. many screenwriters know about it. I just realized today that I was going to give a talk, that I need to give a talk, and I thought I found a title today, and it's Great Places to Stay in Development Hell. And I thought, well, my book is one of the great places to stay in development hell. But more importantly, I'm here with Dr. Lewis Brager. Do you call yourself a psychotherapist or a psychologist?
Both of those.
Okay.
And call me Lou, not
Lou.
Yeah.
You want me to call you Lou? Sir, yeah. Psychotherapist, sir. Lou is the author of many books. He taught at Caltech for a long time, and tell us about the book that's just kind of, I've known Lou for many years, and I'm adapting his book, the book that came out before the one that's coming out next month, A Dream of Undying Fame, which is about a period in a very specific period in Freud's life and in his career, wherein he invented the talking cure, began to do the talking cure, and with his mentor, and who actually was the first to use the talking cure. And Freud really betrayed this person in a very, very specific way, and usurped most credit for this very important work. So I'm working on a film adaptation of this with Joe Swanberg, and Lou has been incredibly supportive and helpful, and he just giving me all kinds of ideas and information, and we've had a wonderful time working on this adaptation. So, Lou, why don't you tell us about the new book?
And I have my fingers crossed, and I appreciate your work on trying to turn this book into a film. Hope it happens.
Well, this is another interesting area of development hell. I don't know if this is as cushy as the one in Peloponnesia. Maybe it's more cushy. It's actually a charmed and lovely place because we talked about the book. I went to a talk where you were speaking about the book, and I realized that there was a way to adapt it, which would be quite interesting, and that I saw. And you were enthusiastic about it, and we were able to get this to this next phase. So we're actually working on a script. So that's the fun part of film development, and the hard part is will we be able to make the film?
Right.
It's always that way. Imagining the film is really part of the pleasures of it. In any case, we say that.
You want me to give you just a very brief summary of these last three books and how they came into being?
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, I published a full biography of Sigmund Freud in 2000, and a number of people who I respect have called it the best biography of Freud ever, and I like to think it is, with all due modesty. And people ask me, how long have you been working on it? Well, it took me about 4.5 years to write it, but I've been working on it for about 40 years, and in the sense that from the beginning of my getting a PhD in psychology, I was interested in Freud and was working with ideas about his theory and publishing academic papers and so on. And finally, this idea for what started out as a paper, and it just sort of took off on its own and turned into this biography of Freud because a lot of things began to fall into place and make sense. So that book came out, and it's called Freud, Darkness in the Midst of Vision. And then my agent in New York, 3 or so years ago, was talking to a publisher, editor at a publishing house, and they were doing a series of great men in the 20th century. And he said, "Are you doing one about Freud?" And she said, "No, we don't have that yet." So he suggested me, and so I got a. Talking about development hell, I got a contract in advance to write this short book, the one that you're working with, Tom, before I even wrote anything. And it's really just a spin-off of the big biography. It takes a particular part of that and expands it into a short book. And that's called The Freud, A Dream of Undying Fame, how Freud betrayed his mentor and invented psychoanalysis. And that's the book that you know, Tom, and are working on to turn into a screenplay. And then I just wrote it in about 3 or 4 months, which is amazingly fast.
And the material that's in the book was something that was in the other book, but it was just touched on in the other book. It wasn't.
That's right. I took parts of the other book and expanded them. Took that one sort of segment of Freud's life and relationship with Joseph Breuer, who was his mentor, and expanded it into that short book that you've been working with. So I kind of knew all the, I didn't have to do any research. I had already done tons of research for the previous biography, and I had all the information. I had to do relatively little, and I could write it fairly quickly. But before I did that one, I had been working on another book, and I came back to it and finished it up, and that's the book that's going to be out in a week or two. And it's called Psychotherapy, Lives Intersecting. And it is based on the responses of more than 30 patients that I've seen over the last 50 years, in which they describe in their own words what was most helpful and therapeutic in our work together, and also what was not helpful. So it's kind of like psychotherapy from the patient's point of view, whereas in almost all accounts of psychotherapy and psychoanalysis are written from the therapist's point of view. I put a little bit of myself in this, in the sense of sort of just identifying the people and saying a little about them. But mostly the book consists of very long quotations from the patients themselves about how they remembered their therapy, what was important, what stood out, what they found most helpful.
And so did you send out a questionnaire? I mean, was it a...
No, I didn't. It was very informal. I just sent them a brief email that said something like, I'm doing this, putting this stuff together, and I'd like to hear from you what was most helpful or therapeutic in our work together, and also what was not helpful, and everything will be treated confidentially. We'll use a pseudonym and disguise things so people won't know who you are, and that's all. I just sent them that. There wasn't anything more like a long questionnaire and so on, because I wanted them to feel spontaneous and free to say, you know, some people focused on one aspect, some on another, some wrote fairly short responses, some wrote long responses. I wanted it to really just completely come from them.
Uh-huh. And what were you surprised by things you heard? I mean, how subjective was it to what your impressions were? I mean,
yes and no. One of the things is it's not a scientific study in the sense that the people who responded were people who by and large had good experiences, and the people who really didn't like working with me or who quit fairly soon and so on were not likely to respond, although I got a few, which I thought was good to give it some balance. And some of them were people that I had worked with for a number of years, and I knew that they found the therapy very helpful, and we had a good relationship, so I wasn't surprised. But I was surprised at the consistency of the kind of things that people found helpful. And if I had to sum that up, I would say, paraphrasing the old political campaign from Bill Clinton's running for office, it's the relationship, stupid. It was not interpretations. It was not getting insight into their unconscious. It was not any of the other things that, say, Freud and Freudians emphasize. It was not figuring out the complex meaning of their dreams or fantasies. It was not the recovery of lost memories. All of those things came up and played some role. But over and over again, what people emphasized was that they experienced the therapy as a relationship with somebody who really was interested in them, really cared about them, listened closely, remembered what they said, was sympathetic and understanding, all of those kind of things is what stood out as most helpful.
And so what is that? I mean, so that relates as much to your personal qualities and just, you know, being able to truly be empathic as it does to the, you know, the technical virtues of your background.
Very much, yeah, very much. And I'm certainly not the only one, and I'm not all that special. I think people that go into the field and become therapists, a lot of them do so because they want to be helpful to troubled people, and they are empathic and sympathetic. A lot of the old psychoanalytic stuff, which said you should be neutral and don't reveal anything about yourself and, you know, all that, really was anti-therapeutic. And that's the way I was trained much earlier on, but it just wasn't in me to be that way. And I think the whole field of analytic, sort of contemporary psychoanalytically oriented therapy has moved in this direction of the therapist being more human, more open about himself, and so on.
And on balance, does that change how people approach going into the field? Do they then say, well, I don't really need to know this, this, and this, and these, you know, the technicalities of psychology and everything that's in the DSM-3, it doesn't really matter?
Well, that's a good question. No, I think it isn't so simple that you can just, you know, if you're a warm and caring person, you can just go in and be a good therapist, and that's all it takes, because you'll see all kinds of people, and some of them have very troubling kinds of symptoms and disturbances, and you got to understand that. And some of them do need medication concomitant with therapy. Some of them need very different kinds of things that you need to do for very specific kinds of conditions. So you got to know more than, you know, just being a nice guy.
And what were the negative things? I mean, were there things where were there patterns on the negative side that you found? I mean, it's a very, you know, brave thing to go out and pull all of your, you know, clients from many years back. I mean,
yeah, as many as I could get in touch with.
Do you know anybody else who's done that? I mean, is that?
I'm sorry.
Do you know anybody else who's done this?
I did sort of a fairly thorough search of the literature, and there has been very little of this done. There's one study where I think the guy's name is Leshering, where they asked, they had about seven patients who were in full psychoanalysis. And most of the write-ups is from the analyst side, but they asked the patients to present their own side, and four of them did so, And those four say very much the same kind of things my patients said. One of them said, for example, I think my analyst emphasizes interpretations and insight more than I do. What I remember is moments when we could share a laugh or have a more human interchange. But to come back to your question, no, there's very little out there like this. There's a lot of psychotherapy research in which they do follow-ups and ask patients, but those are usually done with questionnaires where, you know, the patient has to fill out something and give, you know, checklists or one-sentence answers to questions that come from the researcher.
And this is not, you're not a research psychologist. I mean, this is more of an informal rumination on your own work. Is that how you would class, or you know, just
it's a follow-up study, but it's done in a kind of informal way, but because I wanted the patients to you know, feel free to talk about it in any way they wanted to talk about it,
and not
suggest, you know, I want to know what you thought about the therapy, and please make sure you cover these five topics. That would be my structuring their answer.
And for the reader, it functions as a kind of guidebook or journey across how your practice has, you know, what you've accomplished and what, you know, what have been the, you know, the highs and lows in your own practice, and a way for
sort
of look at what their practice might be now, or if someone's starting out as a therapist, it's a way to sort of look at how that journey might be and envision how they might need to frame themselves for it. Is that
very much? It is. I am of an age where people tend to write memoirs or autobiographies, or kind of look back and say, you know, what was my life all about? And so I do have three chapters of a more autobiographical nature in there, where I have one in which I talk about my childhood and family and background and sort of what it was that got me into being a therapist, and then a couple of chapters about my professional sort of autobiography, where I was, where I taught, what kind of research I did, and so on, all of which oriented me to become the kind of therapist I became. Here's an example of something. There are some people that I've seen over the years that after the therapy was over, we became friends and remain so to this day. One of them was a guy that I saw during my pre-doctoral internship in 1960. You can believe that long ago. And he was somebody that was assigned to me. I was a trainee, and we had several cases, and they were just assigned to us by people that came to the outpatient department. So I saw him for less than a year, once a week, and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. Particularly, I'd done some, you know, a lot of reading, but I had almost no experience. So I saw him, and I didn't know what the result was. It wasn't. He was a pretty mixed up guy. About my age, and about 8 years later, by sheer chance, I went to visit a former student of mine in the hospital where he was after having surgery, and this guy, we call him Ralph in the book as his pseudonym, showed up because the guy I was visiting was his thesis advisor. He was taking a PhD in psychology. So we re-met by chance 8 years later, and then he lived back east, and I would we contacted each other, and when I would go back east from time to time, we'd see each other, and we became friends, and now we're email buddies. So I've known this guy for 50 whatever years. And he wrote up a little thing about his experience of me as a therapist and, you know, how green I was and how I didn't seem to know what I was doing, which was true, and I was mostly silent, just so on. But and he remembered some specific incidents. So that's like a really good starting place. And then people that I saw over the succeeding years up until the present.
And that ability to do that, that's, you know, I mean, that's obviously, it's not the convention of the therapist that we think of, that, you know, that you would have this kind of relationship with one of your patients, but that would seem like it's more possible today, and it's sanctioned as possible in the profession today, whereas before it might have been not considered the right thing to do?
Oh, very much, yeah, very much. Freud strictly forbid it in his when he wrote his papers on how you should do psychoanalysis. And the people that, not that he ever followed his own rules, but the people that followed him, the Freudians and so on, pretty much, you know, the rule was... therapy is therapy, and you confine it to the sessions, and you don't have any contact between therapist and patient afterwards, outside of sessions or after the therapy is over. And not, of course, again, not everybody followed those rules, but those were the rules. And my sense is, why? with some people, you know, you're not the kind of people that you want to be friends with. You don't have much in common. But with some people, there's a growing bond of good feeling that develops over the course of a therapy. And you discover also that you may have things in common. You like the same books. You like the same movies, whatever. And you stay in touch. And I've done that with a relatively small number of these 30 people, but, you know, three or four.
Initially, when you formed more personal relationships with your patients than another might, did you feel like you were possibly, you know, going against the canon of the profession? I mean, how did that...
Yeah, to a certain degree, since I had been trained in a more Freudian institute and had that background. One of the things I do in the book is I formulate what I call the new fundamental rule. Freud's fundamental rule was the patient is instructed to free associate, to say anything and everything that comes to mind and don't hold anything back. My fundamental rule is whatever you do should be for the patient's needs and not the therapist's. So if you think about it in terms of maintaining a friendship after the therapy is over, if the patient wants to, and if you both feel like, you know, you have things in common and so on, but it has to be sort of come from them and be something that they want. Mm-hmm. Not, you know, I do know a number of not very good analysts and therapists who kind of recruit their own patients and former patients to be their followers and supporters, particularly if they're in some kind of a training institute together. And that's sort of, I think, exploiting the patient for your own needs. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really a bad thing to do.
You're not practicing. You have a few. I know you are. You have a few patients who you see still.
Yeah, I have. I've not taken any new patients for 8 years or more, and I just have a small number of people who I'm continue to see by telephone or Skype since I moved from L.A. up to the Bay Area. Who were, you know, not ready to stop. And some of them I talk to every 2 weeks. Some of them I talk to once a month. There are a few I talk to once a week. So they're just sort of like the tail end of my practice of people who we're not ready to stop.
And do you miss the personal contact? I mean, are you? Is it kind of a relief to not be practicing anymore full time?
It is not that I didn't really like doing it. It's just that I've been doing it for so long. I think I was ready to retire and just not have any kind of fixed work that I had to do.
And when I
was in L.A. Before I really retired, it's about 8 or 10 years ago. I had a few extremely traumatized, extremely disturbed patients that I worked with that I had to be in contact with every day, and phone calls and suicide threats and. These were very demanding, difficult people. And so when I did finally retire and they got transferred to other therapists, that was a relief.
So, are you spending more time on writing now than you had been when you were practicing, or did you always have a balance that was sort of a writer schedule and a work schedule?
I started writing when I was my first teaching job after I got my PhD was at the University of Oregon in 1961, and that was, publish or perish. That was the academic world, and I started writing at that time, articles and so on, and published a book in, about 1969, I think the first book came out. It was an edited volume where I had a couple of chapters, and then I've been writing since then. But I was full time at Oregon, and I was full time at UC San Francisco, and then I was a visiting professor at Berkeley, and then I came to Caltech in 1970, and I was a full time professor there until I retired. I'm a professor emeritus now, and there, you were expected to publish. That was to do scholarship and to publish. That was what they were paying you for, plus teaching. And so I was always working on something.
Once you left Caltech, your writing kind of, it increased actually, didn't it?
I think it had become an addiction by that time.
That's what I was getting at.
I couldn't stop
doing
it.
You're a lifer as a writer, and I knew you'd written books, and I know you as a writer, but years ago I knew you'd written books, but I didn't see you as a writer, so to speak. But now I realize that you have to write. I'm wondering, what's your next book going to be after this one?
I think this one may be my last, but who the hell knows? you're right, Tom. I really always thought of myself as primarily a psychotherapist. And interestingly enough, I never thought until this very last book, the one that's just about to come out, I never felt confident enough about my work as a therapist that I could write directly about it. None of my other books before that were, the Freud biography was a biography. It wasn't about me doing therapy. I wrote a book about Dostoevsky, biographical analysis kind of thing. But I finally got to the point where I figured, well, after 50 years, I probably do know what I'm doing, so I can write about it. And that's this current book. But, coming back to writing, since you're a writer also, writing is a, I don't know, what would we call it, Tom? It's a it's a very particular kind of thing where you, even if you're not writing a personal memoir, even if you're writing a book like Peloponnesia, a novel, it's always you. You know, you're exposing yourself as a writer in a particular kind of way, and I think that requires certain things psychologically, like discipline and how you go about it, and who you show it to, and how you feel about the response of your readers, and so on.
I often wonder a lot. You know, I wonder why people write, or what the thing inside is that impels them to write, and what the, you know, and there is a kind of relief and general satisfaction that comes from the reflection, and then putting that reflection in some form of relative precision on the page, or at least trying to express it on the page.
Yes, very much. I
try to sort of differentiate between that process in its rawest forms, and then what the product is, or what the result might be from that process, from that form that it ends up taking. But simultaneously, I understand that, you know, having the harmony between the results and that process is the thing that many people, that one seeks, I suppose. But I still believe that just the process itself of that enunciation is really what it's all about. It's more important.
Exactly, exactly, yeah.
And, you know,
go ahead.
You go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I wrote this book about Dostoevsky. It came out in 1989, I think. And that is the book is called Dostoevsky, the Author as Psychoanalyst, because I think for him, especially for him, but true for almost all real writers, the process of writing was a kind of self-therapy, a kind of self-examination, where he took up certain things that were in his imagination, in himself, and then expressed them through different characters in his novels and saw how they played themselves out.
And how conscious do you think Dostoevsky was as he wrote?
Not in that sense. He, Crime and Punishment, which I think is one of the greatest psychological novels of all time, he started out to write that as a sort of a tract against alcoholism.
Really?
Of course, yeah, because, well, you know, Russia, you know, everybody lives on vodka. There's a lot of drunkenness there, and there was a lot in the middle of the 19th century when he was writing. And that is one of the very small subplots in Crime and Punishment. One of the characters is a heavy drinker, but that's not what the book is all about, really. And I think it's this sort of self-discovery in the process of writing.
Yes, yes. But then the result, if we just take Dostoevsky, did he see the result? Did he feel the result in his career? And, you know,
I think so. Yeah, I at least that's my analysis of him in the book, and based on, you know, reading all the biographies and what is known about him, that he, it's like Crime and Punishment deals with what you might call the issues of very early childhood. It's about mothers that don't give you what you need, and how enraged you become, and as personified with this stingy old pawnbroker that Raskolnikov murders. And it's a kind of, at that level. And then in his next book, he kind of moves up to the different levels of psychological development, so that by his final book, The Brothers Karamazov, he's really dealing with the issues that a young man faces, how to define yourself in the world, you know, issues
so
of identity.
By the time he finished his later writing, he refined his vision of the world and was able to enunciate it more clearly, and maybe saw it more clearly in certain ways?
I'm not sure his vision of the world changed so much as just his understanding of himself and people, and the people being the people in his novels.
And were the people in his novels disembodied versions of himself, or were they?
They're all what we might call multiple self states, or different versions of parts of himself.
That's
go ahead.
My telepanesia, I was trying to identify who am I writing about. Someone asked me, "Who are you writing about? What's this?" And at a certain point, I did start to realize and really came to believe that all the character that I completely identified with all the characters for different reasons.
Right. They're all. I mean, you know, if you're writing something purely out of your imagination, you're not just, you know, taking some story you read in the newspaper or saw on TV and embellishing it, then you're writing about stuff that's you, parts of you.
In psychotherapy, you know, so then if we take, like, the idea that, you know, okay, so I need inspiration today for my story, so I'm going to go observe people and consider people in my life. When I make those considerations, is it kind of the same as what we call transference in psychotherapy, where, you know, you're observing another person, but you're actually filling them with your own self in terms of your observation of them?
Yeah, exactly. You're projecting your own qualities onto them. You're observing someone who is who they are. And everybody's different, but then you're projecting stuff that comes from you. You're not a completely neutral, objective observer. You're a participant observer, and using your own self in what you observe.
And so was the Dostoevsky book kind of a, for you, it was a departure from what you'd written before, and Did that book enable you to write the books that you've written now and your new ones? In a way, it's a personal and courageous book, in the terms that it's your life and your practice.
Yeah, this most recent book, I sort of put myself out there for the world to see. Well, here's me doing therapy with these people, and here's what they say about it. And I even have these more autobiographical chapters. I have to tell you, Tom, it doesn't feel so courageous because I'm of an age where I figure, who the hell cares? So some people will like me, some people won't. You know, I'm different than I was when I was 10 or 20 years younger.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I still think it is. I think some people would say, no, I don't want to look at that. I mean, I don't want to.
I want to
look at the future and look away from that. And I don't want to ruminate on this. And I don't want to open up this Pandora's box and saying to these people who you've done this important work with, well, how was it? You know, how are you? What did I do? What terrible mistakes did I possibly make? I think it's great. Tell me the name of the book and tell me when it's going to be out.
It's Psychotherapy, Lives Intersecting. That is their patient's life and my life. So intersecting. So it's not, psychotherapy is not like going to see a surgeon and having your appendix taken out, where, you know, he's just the doctor and you don't have a relationship. But it's two lives, my life, the particular kind of person I am, and the patient, whoever they are and what they're like, intersecting and interacting. So Psychotherapy, Lives Intersecting, due out January 31st.
All right.
Get it out on time.
Okay. Well,
Do we have more time, Tom, or how long are we?
I think we're kind of done now. This is try to reach the 40-minute limit, and then we're, you know. Do you have other things you wanted to say? We can take a little more time if you want.
Well, no, I just wanted to bring up one other thing that's related to this Dostoevsky. We're great Charles Dickens fans, and I just read a long biography of Dickens that came out last year. And, you know, Charles Dickens, he's full of these what seem almost like stereotyped innocent young things and cruel, sadistic men and so forth. And where did he get them from? Well, he was a great observer. He just would walk around London for hours and hours and observe people. But in a few rare moments when he was talking to people, he said, "They all come from me." He said, even the most evil, horrible creatures in his books, and he has some pretty awful ones, he said, that's me. That's just the part of me I don't want to be, but it's me.
That's great. That's great. That's very interesting. That answers the. That's. Well, are you going to write something about Dickens? Have you thought of doing?
Am I? No. This book has already done it.
Maybe there's some events in Dickens' lives that could be.
There are a number of biographies of Dickens already out, and this one is, I think, a very good one. So.
All right. Well. This was great. Thank you very much for having this conversation with me, and we will be talking soon in private life.
Okay. Can we talk privately a bit when we're off the air? Or are you going to stay on or what?
I can. You know what? I think we have to end this. It records as long as we're on, so I think we'll wrap it up, and then we can talk. I can call you, or call me right now. Okay.
Sure. Are you at your home number?
Yes.
I'll call you at your home number. Okay.
Okay. All right.
Bye-bye. Bye. On the day.